Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very, very senior and accomplished professional, Mr. Atul Bhatnagar. Atul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Atul is a board advisor, a skill development, and a renewable energy professional. He's a former banker, worked with Barclays, HSBC, and Citibank. He found his calling through skill development for persons with disability, and he's been felicitated, awarded, and recognized several times. So Atul, we'll start with our conversation. We're talking about banking and corporate governance. As a banker, how have you seen banking change and evolve over the last three decades?
Thank you, Ashutosh, for giving me this opportunity first. And thanks for the kind introduction. Yes, banking has been part of my career for nearly 22 years across the three banks that you mentioned. And in the last three decades, I joined banking immediately after my management degree. We thought we were at the forefront of technology. And when I look back right now, I feel so ancient and archaic because, I was in Citibank at that time, and we were the first ones to introduce call center. And now call centers are gone. I mean, now we're talking about bot centers kind of stuff, you know? And we were doing that in India, where people were marveling at that. Okay, look, you know, you don't even have phones, and you have phones which dial the wrong numbers, and you're going to have call centers. And customer behavior itself, you know, the customers were initially refusing to come onto the call center because they said, okay, look, if this guy knows my balance, then he can tell somebody else. You know, so you had to bring customer confidence, customer education, all of that. Citibank, was not a very branch-oriented bank, but the other branches of the nationalized banks out here, they were running into thousands, and Citibank had some six branches in the whole of India. So again, we thought that we are doing a technology revolution with six branches. And a million credit cards can be, conquer the financial space in India. And we were number one for quite some time.
Correct.
But look at it today, Citibank has wound up its retail banking completely. The branches are more or less closed down. They are only looking at a very specific target segment as far as retail banking is concerned. I've been a retail banker most of the time, so most of my examples will relate to retail banking.
Sure.
And I do love working with large portfolios of, 2-3-4 million kind of stuff, and find out how we can increase, the banking growth on their basis. Now look at it. Then I moved to HSBC, and I'll just give you a kind of a change in the behavior between banks itself. I mean, Citibank was...
Yeah, could I request you to be a little brief, because there's a lot of questions that I'd like to go.
Okay, sure. So now if I see, it's like looking at more or less branchless banking, very heavily technology oriented, and much more, advanced than what it used to be three decades back. So again, going back to my initial statement, I feel archaic in the current day and age.
Wonderful. But, you know, banking has changed a lot over the last three decades, and there is a lot of digitization that has changed banks completely. In fact, the brick and mortar branches have also started to question whether they're really needed. My question to you is, how is the digital revolution bringing about financial inclusion?
Now it's banking as a service that has come in. So previously it was SaaS, now it's BaaS. So SaaS ki BaaS aage, matlab that way. It's a new way of thinking that has come in. So the banking system is a common system being utilized by a number of small fintech or startups. They promise an account to be opened in less than 5 minutes. They can get you a loan in 59 minutes. All these were unheard of. Now, these people, they are, nimble and fast. It's like, you have a big aircraft carrier, Navy ship, which takes some time to move around because, it has to change course. It takes a long radius to do that. And these people are the fleet boats, which can really move very fast, move in any direction that they want. And there can be multiple of them. So that is going to lead to financial inclusion because they are now using mobile as a way of banking people. And I'm coming from, let's say I was in Barclays in Kenya. In 2005, they started this mobile revolution there. Mm-hmm. And there your mobile number is your banking number, is your bank account, really. Because, and only 4 million people out of 36 million people are banked. But 26 million people actually operate on the mobile.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the financial inclusion that's happened there. Similar thing is happening in India, more and more so because of smartphones proliferation all over the place.
Very interesting. And do you see India or the world moving towards a cashless economy, or do you see cash continuing to be king?
I don't think so. Cash will survive long, really. I mean, unless people in India think of cash in other ways, because it has been... they call it black money. I don't call it black money really, because I'm coming from Africa. Black money is a racist term there. Mm. So they talk about money in the gray market. Mm. So that's where the cash really lies.
Okay.
But having said so, now since every transaction can be monitored, sooner than later, cash will disappear if it is to be used as cash in the informal economy, let's say. And it's like, you know, you can pay anybody and everybody. Like say in Kenya, my domestic staff, the cleaner and the maid and the driver didn't want cash. They said, just put the money into our mobile account and that's it. So this is 2008 and we are 13 years down the road, and India is surely, with the way things are moving, I wouldn't be surprised in the next 2 years, things will change completely.
Mm. Very interesting. And one more question. I mean, you know, since you work in India and outside India, what is your perspective in terms of, and you're a retail banker also, what is your perspective and expectations of customers over the years? So my specific question is, how are millennials and Gen Zs changing banking?
Well, speed. I mean, they are so... hell-bent on speed. Today I was seeing a new WhatsApp on a Tesla phone, which can do some 200 megabytes per second kind of downloads, etc. And 5G technologies, and they're saying Tesla is going to compete now with the Apples and the Samsungs, etc. This is what's come to millennials and Gen Zs. I mean, I see my own son, if the phone lags by even a millisecond while swiping left to right or right to left, whichever way, they say it's old and down. And now I see that translate on a bigger screen when you get these fintechs advertising the loan in 5 minutes and whatever other things. So because in the background, they're doing all the checks and all the technologies possible. And that is creating a kind of a, let's say, technology revolution within the financial industry, where the only way you can succeed is speed. See, speed and customer service, of course. I mean, that's where it comes to.
Correct.
And the second very interesting point in the millennials is that they are also looking for a social angle to whatever you're doing.
Correct?
So they are not going to be associated with the premium banking customers, and which was like, you know, pampering the guy because he's got tons of money. No, they are going to look at what is my organization where I'm banking with doing in terms of pollution, climate action, CSR, all those kinds of things. And that's going to get them customers. So the banks also have to change in that front, because there's a much larger agenda that appeals to the people in millennials compared to our generation.
Amazing. So Atul, I'm going to move to the next segment. I mean, you know, you are a board advisor. Tell me about the kind of role that you would play as an advisor, and what would you look for before accepting a board position?
Well, I would look at the nature of work being done by the company itself, and how true are they to it. I mean, they may claim that they have a social angle and they might be doing something to avoid taxes. That's not done, correct? So if you are having a social bent of mind, and it all starts from the promoters and the CEO, very frankly. They both have to be aligned on that respect. And we, I started my life in Tata Motors, really. And Tatas have been known for, they don't get the maximum profit, so they always place people above profits and progress. I think that's a big mantra that I like to go ahead with. You know, it's the people you have to work with first, and the rest will follow. I mean, in fact, the reputation of Tatas is something that has been built over the years, and none of the new bees are kind of anywhere near that kind of solidity and respect that the Tatas are getting. So I would, my aim would be to take me as a broad advisor, as a, let's say, as a responsibility, that can I take the company that I'm associated with to that levels of respect, and of course, make the profit on the side anyway.
Fascinating. My next question to you is on transparency, you know, transparency, and that of course is a part of a larger role of, you know, larger subject of governance. The level of transparency is different across different boardrooms. What must be done to improve transparency in Indian corporate boardrooms?
I think diversity is first, really. I mean, it's not about getting women on the board itself, but maybe people would, I mean, I'm not going to the LGBTQ and all this. Okay, look, you have a representative from everybody. But to have transparency also means you have a diverse set of views from different areas. I mean, so it's not just that, you know, people who have MBA degrees and fancy ideas should be there. It's about maybe if you're working on the ground level, then you have to have somebody from the rooted from the ground who is there to give you that perspective. And when you have that perspective, your transparency automatically opens up because you know this person is from that particular market, and you have staffed him, you have brought him into the board with a certain, let's say, agenda, and you have to honor that agenda. So I think diversity is one. And of course, second is the technology bit itself. To look, whatever is being said and done is recorded the way it is being said and done. And no, doesn't matter if the the shareholders, in fact, the shareholders are very forgiving. If you tell them, okay, look, yeah, we made a mistake. Great. This is what we're doing. This is how you're going to correct it. Maybe the share price might go up and down on a particular day, but it'll finally come up because humans like to trust other people. And they like, okay, look, somebody has made a mistake, you own it, you then try and reverse it and make it better. I think that's the, I think the word is transparency, definitely, but transparency has to be more in walking the talk rather than just talk.
Very interesting. And my next question to you is that before an individual agrees to take up the role of an independent director, knowing fully well that the fiduciary responsibility is the same as an executive director, what are some of the precautions they should look for?
Well, they should, as I go back, it's the, I've been, you know, I'm chief operating officer. I used to keep saying that I don't run operations. I run people who run operations. So it's the people which matter here. So when I say people, again, going back to, look, the chairman of the board, the CEO and your other directors, and when you put up, let's say, I mean, how can a debate happen when there are some contentious issues? How is it being recorded? And if you were to see the power, so it's like the people on the board level and people down, and the intent of those people is what is very critical. So I would rather, when I associate myself with a certain organization, I do look up and below and look at how is this particular company going to move forward. And if that's, and there's no checklist that I have, but yeah, if there are certain vibes you get, if it matches with your own value system, you sign up.
Okay. So now let's move to the National Skill Development Corporation. And when I was reading about you, you mentioned that you're very passionate about NSDC. Tell me about the work that you do at the NSDC.
Well, I used to do the work. I mean, I'm now out of NSDC. But when I came back from abroad, I thought this was my payback time to India by joining the National Skill Development Corporation. Reason being that even though, let's say, I am so-called highly educated with my degrees, etc., there are so many people who are, let's say, school dropouts. And if they don't get educated, then what is the alternate career development for them? And that, I think, is skill development. Second, I found that even in India, the certified skills are very less. When I say certified skills means, I mean, somebody might have an ITI degree or a polytechnic, piece of paper saying that he or she has done some course. Whereas South Korea has got 95% people are certified skilled. Mm-hmm. Japan has got somewhere in the 80s, and Germany and US, all these are very counted in the 70s and all. India is less than 5%. And yet, it's not that Indians are not skilled, otherwise the country will be in shambles. Mm-hmm. We also built a Taj Mahal, which is the vagaries of time. And of course, our new buildings fall within 20 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a different issue. But the skills are not certified. Mm-hmm. My main aim here was, look, after having been abroad and having acquired a certain set of skills, can I be part of a nation building exercise here, or I would say a mission now, because it's called a Skill India Mission, where we can take a large mass of people and skill them in what the industry wants. Mm-hmm. And typically our education system is lacking that. Our education system is simply, for 12 years, thou shalt be part of a class, thou shalt spend 1 year, then thou shalt be going through an exam, and then thou shalt move into the next class, and so on and so forth. Our main aim was, can I teach in 12 weeks what those people couldn't teach in 12 years? Mm-hmm. And the skills that the company wants, what the industry wants. So industry wants more ward boys in a healthcare system, then we will be producing healthcare.
Right.
We are not going to be saying that he should be 10th pass with science and 12th pass or with biology and so on and so forth. And the whole, again, if I go back to the South Korea example, in 1980, you won't remember a single product from South Korea. Mm-hmm. And today there is at least one in your home or in your pocket, or somebody in your family member will be having. How did that happen? How did that transformation happen? And nobody talks about how many PhDs and how many MBAs and how many papers were written in South Korea. The people are certified skilled, and they are creating a mark. In fact, there's a skills Olympiad that happens every 4 years at the international level, and South Korea wraps up 50% of the medals there. It shows. So what I'm saying is, I'm not going against education. Education, first of all, education is a learning for life. Correct. So you can, even today, when I say I'm getting archaic in banking, I'm learning myself. Look, how do I keep myself up to pace? So my learning has not stopped just because I had a degree some 30 years back. So it's carrying on. So that should carry on for everybody. I mean, who cares if you get a graduation degree at age 40? The thing is, you should be able to get onto your feet, be able to skill yourself for a particular degree and start for a particular job and start earning. And as you go through your life careers, and you educate yourself on the side. And now everything is very digital, so you can do whichever course you want. So it's not that you have to subscribe to university. Previously, it was all correspondence courses or night classes or weekend classes kind of stuff. But now it's all there on your mobile. You can be sitting in a bus and getting yourself skilled on some new kind of technology. So,
you did a lot of work with persons with disabilities. So help me understand the kind of work that you were doing with them, and what are some of the challenges and opportunities that have now come up for them?
People with disabilities, let me give you the macro view first, that there are nearly 2.68 crore people in India with disabilities of seven kinds. There are seven disabilities that were, categorized by Government of India. But in 2016, they have increased to 21 disabilities. With 21 disabilities, there's a WHO report that nearly 1 billion people around the world will be classified as disabled. Mm-hmm. And in India, this figure could be between 8 to 10 crores. Now, this is the target segment that we need to look at. Our main aim is, can we mainstream them? And not only mainstream them through pity and donations, but give them, again, teaching them how to fish so that they can fish for life. Mm-hmm. So how do we empower them through skill development and employment? That is very critical. And that age category is between 18 to 35. Mm. That is one portion we look up. So we hook up with corporates. We try and make them understand the reason for to employ these people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And we have found that the productivity is higher, actually, because they are very loyal. Once they're given a job, they're very loyal to it. Mm-hmm. They don't spend time looking WhatsApp and having coffee breaks. Mm-hmm. They're given a particular work to be done. yes, they can't do all the work, all that's possible, but there are certain job roles. And now with COVID being a big leveler, it's actually become an opportunity for us, because I'm now reaching out to corporates, and corporates have started thinking, is jobs that can be done from home, previously maybe done by a person without disability, why can't it be done by a person with disability, staying at home itself? And there's that opens up a very big arena of this people where they can be absorbed. Then 0 to 5 is another segment that we have to look at. And as parents, or now as grandparents, we need to understand this, that a child's disability, if it's noticed between the 0 to 5 year age group, there's a good chance that it might be cured, and there's a good chance it might be arrested from going bad. But the education amongst even the most educated people in India is like, no, you know, it happened, it'll set right. But we need to get that sorted out. So if that happens, then obviously the people, when they get into bigger age groups, they at least it'll be under control, let's say, or it'll be managed. And the third part, which I actually kind of tell people, is look, we're also getting old, correct? Another maybe 15, 20 years, my hearing will be impaired. Mm-hmm. My eyesight might be impaired. Mm-hmm. And my physical abilities might be impaired. Mm-hmm. So I'll be becoming more and more disabled, very frankly. Mm-hmm. And old age is something you can't wish by. I know age is a number and all that, but that's fine. But can I, on my own, hail an Uber, go to a mall on my own without having to ask my children to help me get into a car or come and pick me up? Can I move into a movie hall, climb up the stairs or a ramp somewhere, choose the seat that I want? Can I come home? And I mean, one thing that I did in my own home was, increase the pathways to the toilets itself, because so that a wheelchair can go in. How many people think about that? Or can I sit on a wheelchair and make Maggie on the gas itself and have the switches? Imagine your own, when you charge your phone in the night, you have to bend down and put your cords in. Mm-hmm. Can it be at a more convenient place? So just think in terms of a world which can suffice your needs when you get old. And if you want to see that world emerge, maybe when you are getting older, you can feel comfortable. Let there be a selfish agenda. Mm-hmm. Why don't you make the world now? If that happens, inclusivity always happens. It will support the people with disabilities. It'll support people with old age in the same way. And because otherwise we will be disabled at that time, we'll have all kinds of ego problems, because we'll say, we used to rush fast and we could move this way, that way, and now I can't do it. And you'll be feeling quite depressed. And the people who've been, let's say, differently enabled will be differently enabled at that time also.
Fascinating. Athol, on that note, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for talking to me at such length on banking, on transparency, on governance, and most importantly, talking to me about the National Skill Development Corporation and all the amazing work that you have done and the work that is continuing to be done in the NSDC. Thank you again and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.